Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Richard Davis. I'm a professor in the School of Public Policy, and I'm delighted to welcome you all here this evening. Now, as you know, at these events, and some of you will have been to them before, you have to sort of start off by saying some nice stuff about the presenter and how they're a wonderful person. And I'm sure it's always true, but this evening it genuinely is true, and it's true for me personally. Phil Coggan is not only one of the most respected financial and, more than that, social, political journalists in the country. He's done a huge stint both at the Financial Times and at The Economist, but he also played a very big role in my life. I went from being a central banker and writing in a rather turgid way to working in an office right next door to Phil when I became a journalist, and he was one of the key people that gave me advice during that time, particularly on the sort of turgid style, and encouraged me to be a bit more exciting, I remember, which worked out well for me, and it's something that I'll always be really grateful for. So I wanted to start out by saying thank you to Phil for the role he's played in my life. On top of that, he has very quickly and incredibly turned round a brand new book, The Economic Consequences of Mr. Trump. It's a reference, the title, which I'm sure he will explain to us, I think a clever reference. The way we're going to play tonight is Phil is going to give a kind of mini lecture, 20 minutes or so. I will then use my kind of chair's privilege to ask him a couple of questions, and then we'll very quickly open it up to you guys. Oh, great, we've got people at the top as well. So get your questions ready. I'll see if I can come up to the top as well. And then we will answer as many as we possibly can. Three bits of housekeeping, if I may, and then it'll be over to Phil. First one is you should have received a little bookmark. You're all bookworms. The fact you're here, you have got a bookmark. Brilliant. If you scan the QR code on your bookmark, you can find your way to our Substack. Substack's a new thing, kind of taking over. You can also find Phil on Substack, Phil Coggan on Substack. And then the final advert is next Monday, I think it is our next event, and that's with Jeremy Hunt. Okay, so please do come along to that. Okay, that's it from me. Phil, tell us about the economic consequences of Mr. Trump.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Richard, for that extraordinarily generous. I'm sure you were a very good writer when you arrived, so I'm not sure I taught you anything, really. The reason this book is called The Economic Consequences of Mr. Trump is a reference to an event 100 years ago. Winston Churchill decided to take Britain back onto the gold standard, and John Maynard Keynes, the great economist, advised against that decision and then produced an instant book, The Economic Consequences of Mr. Churchill, where he argued it was a terrible mistake. And on April the 2nd, I saw the tariff announcement from Donald Trump, and the historical parallel was just so strong that I did write a short Substack. And then Claire, my publisher, I sent her a message saying, how about we write a quick book and a la Keynes and try and point out the stupidity of this. And I didn't actually think she would do it. As my wife says, I'm the dog who caught the car. But then she said yes. And so by the end of May, I wrote the book. And I managed to write it because there's so much to say on this subject, because the decision was so strange and so damaging that it needed to be written. And the parallel between Churchill and Trump is striking, because Churchill did this out of nostalgia. Britain had been on the gold standard before the First World War. It was associated with the great economic and financial strength of Britain, and he thought going back to it would be a good idea, but it wasn't. As Keynes pointed out, it would lead to deflation, and it led to the general strike. And Trump's decision is made out of nostalgia for this time in the 1950s and 60s when men were men and they had a job at the car factory and they earned enough to own a car and, you know, all the gadgets, and that's what he sort of seems to be aiming for. That's what his appeal to the electorate is. And that also is a mistake, because he will not create the same conditions that allowed manufacturing to be a large part of the US workforce. So I think the key point we also need to understand is that Trump has unleashed pretty much chaos in economic policy from the day, and not just economic policy, from the day he took office. Tariffs have been raised, they've been lowered, they've been suspended, they've been applied to some countries and not others, then to all countries and then taken away from some countries. They've been applied to some products and not others. And then there's threats of tariffs. We had 100% on foreign movies briefly. We just recently had 200% on pharmaceuticals. In the context of all this, how is a business supposed to operate? Supposing you decided, oh, well, Trump's maybe right, I'll move my business from Vietnam and put it in the US. But from one day to the next, you don't know what the tariffs are going to be. You don't know if they'll be suspended. So you will wait, and that means no investment while you wait to see what the final policy is. And of course, we may never know what the final policy is because he likes to change his mind every 5 minutes. And he imposes tariffs not just for economic reasons, but for political reasons, the most recent one being, for example, the threat to Brazil on 50% tariffs. US has a trade surplus with Brazil, by the way, just because it's trying Javier Bolsonaro for trying to organise a coup. So in this brief talk, I want to argue four things. The first is that the US trade deficit is not a crisis, particularly not given the US's financial strength. The second thing is that it's not caused, the US trade deficit is not caused by other countries' tariffs, and raising tariffs will not address it. The third thing is that it will not bring back manufacturing jobs, as I've already mentioned. And finally, tariffs are part of a sort of broader Trump agenda that is immensely destructive to the global economy, bringing down international institutions, threatening allies, threatening the US strength in scientific research. And all this is extremely damaging and may continue for another 3.5 years. But we must not forget this key point about the chaos. Some of Trump's supporters argue that he is pursuing a policy of four-dimensional chess. But I think you need to apply Occam's razor to this. Occam's razor, the simplest answer is the likely to be the correct one. And it's the series of announcements are so chaotic because there is no plan. He's not playing four-dimensional chess. He's playing darts with a javelin. And basically all he's going to do is smash the board and cause potential danger to everybody around him. And it's also based on a fundamental misunderstanding of what the global economy is all about. He keeps thinking about US cars, Canadian cars, Japanese cars. But US cars are not made purely of US components. Indeed, about 50% of a US car is foreign components. And 45% of all that the US imports is stuff that is raw materials or components that go into things that the US makes. So when you put a tax, and a tariff is a tax, on those components, you're increasing the costs of your own producers. And he just doesn't understand global supply chains. Indeed, anything that you, any product that you consume is likely to be the result of a huge global supply chain. The iPhone is the result of 187 suppliers in 28 different countries. Those suppliers will all have their own supply chains. When the iPhone is made, it must be shipped across the world and then transported by truck to a retailer or a warehouse. The ship needs to be built and has its own supply chain. The trucking company has its own supply chain. The retailer, the warehouse, all have their own supply chain. So almost anything that you consume about your house is the product not just of a few people, but of hundreds of thousands of people that have contributed in some small way. And trade is linked to specialization. If you look around your house, think of how many products you could actually make that you could see. And the chances are there'd be precious few. And if you did try and make them, it would take an extraordinary amount of your time, cost more, and probably not work as well. There's a wonderful example. I think the guy was called Thomas Thwaites. He spent 2 years building a toaster from the original parts, and it worked for 5 seconds before catching fire and breaking again, and cost him several thousand pounds to produce. So it's much more efficient for us to earn money doing the things we're good at, and then use that money to buy goods from other people. And the same applies to countries. It's much more efficient for a country like the US to specialise in making high-value products and import lower-value products from other countries. And that makes the whole thing more efficient. There was a recent study of Dutch businesses, and they found that exporters were the most efficient businesses in the economy, and the second most efficient businesses in the economy were the people who supplied exporters. The least efficient businesses in the economy were people who just supplied domestic consumers. And that's for the very good reason that it's most competitive in the export market, so you need to be efficient if you're going to sell around the world. So the idea that Trump seems to have is that exports are good and that imports are bad. This was debunked by Adam Smith in 1776, so he's only 250 years out of date. And it seems an extraordinary thing. It's like the idea that going to work is good, but spending the money that we earn from work is bad. But we export things in the UK or the US so we can afford to import things. Trade deficits are not disastrous, particularly not for the US, which finds it easy to attract international investors. The corollary of a current account deficit, and I'm with a professor of economics over here, I'm waiting to make a mistake and have him correct me, but anyway, is that foreigners accumulate claims on that economy. So they may have bank accounts, they may have bonds, they may have shares. And that's a problem if the foreigners don't really want to own assets in that economy. But the US equity market is around 70% of the global market by value. The US bond market is the most liquid in the world. Foreigners have always been very, very happy to own assets in the US. Another way of thinking about this is that countries that run a current account deficit have insufficient savings domestically to meet the investment they want to make. So they import their savings from abroad. And that makes perfect sense for the US, has lots of exciting investment opportunities. People are happy to supply the savings that, you know, in the tech companies, for example, that it wants. Now, how do they end up with this deficit on domestic savings? Well, the biggest borrower in the US is the government. And Trump has just added the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget estimates $5 trillion over the next 10 years by extending the previous tax cuts and announcing some more. So by doing that, expanding the budget deficit, he will make the trade deficit worse, not better, despite all the tariffs. Now, what about tariffs as a way of reallocating trade? There was a study from IMF economists of more than 150 countries over 50 years, and they found that tariff increases had adverse effects on output and productivity and led to higher unemployment and greater inequality. So they don't work. They're not helpful. Trump's made much of the tariffs being an external revenue service, but the tax is paid by the importing company. They may ask suppliers to cut prices to compensate, of course, but studies suggest that the bulk of the burden of tariffs, the incidence, as economists would say, falls on domestic consumers and companies. Walmart, the world's biggest retailer, has already announced that it will have to pass much of the tariffs onto consumers. And this is especially true when tariffs are ridiculously high. So he announced, I think, or suggested, 100% tariff on Russian products. So you've got a product that costs $50 and the tariff is another $50. So if you're the importer from Russia, you can't say, well, I know you're charging me $50, but could you knock $50 off that, please, to account for the tariff and give it me for free? Well, obviously, they're not going to do that. So you have to, even if they absorb a small portion of that $50 tariff, the bulk of the tariff has to be passed on. Studies also suggest that the burden of tariff falls more on lower-income consumers. If you don't even account for the budget deficit, then the effect of tariffs would be to cut the income of lower-income consumers significantly. I think 1.6% is the study I saw. And then those tariff revenues are going to be used to justify a tax cut for the wealthy. And furthermore, the argument that tariffs can raise a lot of revenue, which Trump has made, can't simultaneously be true if it's going to drastically reduce the level of imports. Either you raise a lot of money or you eliminate imports. It can't be both. In May, tariffs raised $24.5 billion. sounds good. People, there have been talk about how impressive it is. But that compares with the government deficit for the month at $316 billion. Trump's talked about replacing income tax with tariffs, but income tax raised $2.4 trillion last year. It's just not going to do it. Then there's the way that the tariff formula is calculated. The April the 2nd formula was nonsense. It was based on dividing the goods they imported, the US imported from a country, by the trade deficit with that particular country. It wasn't reciprocal at all, despite what he said. The new proposals announced on July the 7th just seem to be a rehash of the April the 2nd plan. So he's just repeating himself. Back to the futile is the way, I think, is best way of describing it. And the formula is just based on goods, not services. It's based on the deficit in 1 year and not over time when trade deficits alter. It cited a formula from a particular group of academics, and the academic came out to say that he got the numbers wrong, that he'd actually underhit the formula that Trump used. The tariffs would be four times too high. The maximum one should be 13% and not 50%. The trade deficit has nothing to do with tariffs imposed by other countries. The US ran a trade surplus in 1991, that was the last time, and tariffs were much, much higher then than they are now. The biggest deficit they had as a proportion of GDP was in 2006, 15 years later, and tariffs had fallen significantly over that period. So it's not about tariffs. What about the supposed deals that are going to result from Trump's negotiations? Britain's version, as you may know, was a five-page document, which on the first page said, this is not a legally binding agreement. If you saw the coverage from the G7, Trump dropped the papers for this new updated version, and the page he dropped was a blank page with his signature at the bottom. So there's just no details in any of these deals. The same was true for Vietnam. We don't know the details of the deal. Vietnam has signed a deal lowering the tariffs from what he wanted was 46%, I think, to 20%. And it's not imposing any tariffs in return. So this is not a reciprocal deal at all. And one, I think we should make one final point about tariffs. I've been, as Richard pointed out, in journalism a very long time. And I've been listening to lectures from people like Jeremy Hunt, who's coming here next week, about how it's terrible to interfere in the free market. You can't have minimum wages. You can't have employment rights. It's interfering in the free market between employer and employee. But how much of an intervention in the free market is imposing a tariff to try and make suppliers buy from one, to make producers buy from one supplier rather than another? That's massive intervention in the free market. But what about the jobs? This is, I think, the reason, the electoral appeal of Trump in terms of saying why he's doing this. And I think I've just remembered that I've missed doing a slide. So let me go. There's about 45% of US imports come from goods. The next one is, this is a graph on manufacturing employed jobs in the Western world as a proportion of the total. It only runs up to 2003. One reason for that is that's the graph I could get. But another reason for that is that China joined the WTO in 2001. So you can see across the map here that manufacturing jobs have been falling as a proportion of the total all through the period from back to 1970. It fell significantly in the US. It's a pretty constant decline as a red line. There was a little bit of a fall, extra fall, after China joined the WTO, but the decline was long set in. Germany, which runs a trade surplus, it has also seen a significant decline in its manufacturing jobs. And the reason for that is not trade, it's technology. That shows up best, I think, in the coal industry, which is not a classic manufacturing industry, but the data is very useful for it. So here's coal mining jobs. It's very similar in the UK, of course. A lot in the mid-80s, steady decline over the last 40 years. This is coal production, however. Coal production peaked only in about 2006, 2007. So while those jobs are falling, they were still digging more coal out. In fact, they blast mountaintops now. It's incredibly destructive, and get the coal out. So it wasn't, and was it trade? Was it foreign coal? No. If you look at US coal imports, that's that red line on the bottom, there hardly have ever been any. So technology has changed manufacturing to reduce the number of jobs needed. And the same thing happened, of course, with agriculture over the last 200 years. 200 years ago, almost everybody worked in agriculture. Now, 1% to 2% of the workforce works in agriculture. Does that mean we have no food? Of course not. We're feeding 8 billion people with existing agriculture because technology has made agriculture a lot more efficient. Another point I think that's important to make is that US companies buy goods from overseas because they are more efficient and they're cheaper, or they're not available at home. And so the US manufacturing sector has switched its focus to these high-valued goods, aerospace, technology, and so on. It's switched away from things like textiles and shoes. Now, to bring back all that manufacturing to the US, you'd have to try and either pay US workers the wages earned in Bangladesh or Vietnam, or you'd have to charge a lot more for shoes and textiles, which would mean bigger bills for poorer consumers. And it would probably divert resources away from the high-value production that the US specializes in into low-value production. There's already a shortage of manufacturing workers in many factories. I don't know if you saw the opinion poll. I think 80% of Americans thought that they should be more manufacturing jobs. Only 20% of Americans would actually like a manufacturing job if one was offered to them. The manufacturing jobs are not always that great. Now, the damage of Trump's agenda is not confined to trade. The assaults on the independence of the Federal Reserve have already weakened the dollar. Even if Jerome Powell, who's the Fed chairman, is not fired, the suspicion is that Trump will replace him with someone who's rather more pliant, who'd be more willing to cut interest rates. That would probably lead to excessively easy monetary policy and higher inflation. We saw a very good example in Turkey of what happens when the central bank gets dominated by the government. And that leads to another worry, the potential for the administration to try and fiddle with the data, call it fake news, and say there isn't really an inflation. And this is the classic pattern that we see in some dictatorships. Big deficits of the kind that Trump has pushed through will also push up interest rates, other things being equal. And while deficits may be justified at a time that the economy is short of demand, that's not the case now. Unemployment is very low. So we could end up with both higher inflation and slower growth. And the Trump fiscal package is a kind of reverse Robin Hood deal that takes money from the poor in terms of cuts to Medicaid and food aid and transfers to the rich in the form of tax cuts. And it adds to the massive inequality that's already present in the US. The top 10% of Americans, that their share of disposable income is higher than in any other OECD nation bar Chile. Their share of wealth is 16 percentage points higher than in any other OECD nation. And this is a key point when people might argue that Trump's addressing some core demand from his voters and that voters hate globalization and Trump is their vehicle of retribution. China didn't make the US an economically unequal country because all the other countries that are more equal are also exposed to globalization. China didn't make US unemployment benefits less generous than other countries. China didn't make the US the rare OECD country without offering any federal paid holiday leave or maternity leave or sick leave. These are all the results of domestic US policies and things that Trump is likely to make worse. And two other negative impacts are worth mentioning before I finish. The first is the assault by Trump on scientific research and the academic establishment. One example is the National Institutes for Health. It funded 90% of all the drugs created, 99%, sorry, of all the drugs created between 2010 and 2020. And it's been estimated that $1 of funding for the National Institutes for Health generated $2.56 worth of economic growth. Undermining research is undermining one of the key foundations of US economic growth. The second problem is that Trump is a totally unreliable counterparty. He's not a deal maker, he's a deal breaker. The first victims of tariffs were Mexico and Canada, two nations with which he did a deal in his first term, which he trumpeted as a great deal for everyone. And the initial rationale for that, those tariffs, were illegal immigration and fentanyl, particularly ridiculous in the case of Canada. Since then, he's threatened to incorporate Canada as a 51st state, to annex Greenland, which is governed by a NATO ally, and to seize the Panama Canal. Now, all this may have been bluster. But who's to know? The key point is after 80 years in which the US was the center of the Western alliance, it's breaking international trade agreements, threatening allies, and questioning the role of NATO. I know today he didn't question the role of NATO. Next week, who can tell? Nor, after his refusal to accept the 2020 election, the threats towards the press and the courts, is the US a model for other democracies to follow. This is a loss of soft power, and an informal American empire is disintegrating, as leaders of both Canada and Germany have remarked in recent years. For our financial markets have, with one exception, been unconcerned about all these issues recently. The stock markets recovered from April's decline because of the so-called taco trade, which stands for Trump always chickens out. I, like Private Eye, had the frittata, which is frequently raises international tariffs, then alters terms afterwards, which I think is probably better. But anyway, we have seen a decline in the dollar. It's the biggest fall since 1973 when Nixon was in power and on his second term. There's some little parallels there. But there are a couple of theoretical problems with the taco trade. The first is, if the market stops reacting to Trump's tariff threats, then he probably thinks that they're not worried. Indeed, he recently said that the market's taken the new set of tariffs very well. So that will encourage him to go ahead. Secondly, if the markets assume it's a bluff, but other leaders of other countries have assumed it's not a bluff, otherwise they won't negotiate with him. They can't both be true. And I think that seems like a recipe for escalation. So what will be the economic consequences of Mr. Trump? I think there'll be higher inflation, there'll be slower growth, there'll be greater inequality, and a weakening of the ties that bind together the Western world. Already we've seen signs of the problems to come. There was a very weak first quarter in the US in terms of growth. There have been declines in business and consumer confidence. US consumer spending went down in real terms between December and May. And while higher inflation may take a few months more to filter through because a lot of people bought stuff in advance of the tariffs, the figures just released today showed an increase in both headline and the core numbers. And it's worth noting, too, that a Fed study found that the crackdown on immigration that Trump is pushing through, which could be the subject of a whole nother talk, is likely to cut US growth by between 0.75 percentage points. World trade has blossomed since the Second World War. It's pushed up 45 times in volume terms. It's drawn many people, many hundreds of millions of people, out of global poverty. And one of the key provisions of that has been the most favored nation rule, which means that a country offers a deal to one nation, it must offer it to all. Trump is just smashing this with no idea on how to replace it. Where there is order, where there was order, he has brought chaos. He has taken everything that actually made America great and is undermining it. Americans thought they were voting for strong leadership, but all they're getting is wrong leadership. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Phil. That was great. So I'm going to monopolise Phil for about 5-10 minutes, and then it's going to be over to you. So please do get your questions ready. There are people with roving mics stationed around. And as I said, people at the top, it's always good. You always know you've done well when there are people at the top, by the way.
Oh, yes. Oh, good. They haven't left yet. So
no, they haven't. We'll get questions from you if we can. First question, and just briefly, if I may. I'm sure some people will be interested in this, and I definitely am. What's your writing process, Phil? How many hours do you work a day? How did you manage to do this thing so quickly?
I've written many books, and the last one, really, the big one before this, was one of Global History, which took me 4 years. This one came out in 5 weeks, but it just poured out of me because I hope I was eloquent enough. I know I stumbled over a few words, but it's so idiotic. It's so counter to everything one was taught about economics, to everything that is in the interest of the people who actually voted for Mr. Trump, that it's just... somebody had to say it, and I know other people, Paul Krugman, Martin Wolf, you know, very eloquently say these things. But I just wanted to get out quickly an explanation of why these policies are so misguided. As I say, you know, almost no aspect of it makes any sense. And so I sat down, my wife's here, I was, we had a week of the time of writing, we were on holiday, I was in Unst, which is the most northerly island in the British Isles, it's on the top of the Shetlands, and I was determined to do the most northerly walk in Britain, and I dragged around with me. And we sat in this cottage overlooking the seals and gannets and things, and I, for a couple of hours a day, I wrote then. Mm. But I could barely contain myself to write it.
Sounds very Orwellian, not in the way people normally use that word. I think he did some of his books from a place like that.
Yeah.
Now, towards the end of your talk, you used some language which sounded to me a little bit like David Ricardo. I'm going to absolutely butcher it here, but for those of you that are interested in free trade and believe in free trade, take a look at Ricardo's original work, and somewhere in there, there's a statement which is kind of his vision of what trade should and can be. And he definitely uses a phrase along the lines of bind together people of the free world in a mutual state of understanding and so on. And it's just a hugely optimistic and hopeful vision for the world. I think that's the kind of starting point. That's definitely my starting point. But I want to kind of push back with two questions and then I'll open it up. And both of them come from what you might call the kind of Peter Mandelson defence. Right. So the Peter Mandelson defence, he recently, people may have seen, he said there's an element of truth in everything that Trump says. There's some kind of grain of truth there. So two questions. First one, where do you stand? You clearly said you don't think current accounts are bad, nor do I think they're bad. And you also clearly explained how the thing that offsets the current account is the capital account. So if your current account is in deficit, your capital account must be in surplus, assuming some other stuff. So that means you're good at selling. You sell a lot of capital stuff. We in the UK have an extensive current account deficit, same as the US. It's been there. It's chronic, you would call it. And people kind of say, you know, this isn't a problem. We're good at selling stuff. And then at the same time, you'll get a story in the news. Oh, why are 15 of the Premiership clubs foreign owned? Why are ports becoming foreign owned? Why is Jaguar Land Rover now owned by an Indian company? Why is steelmaking foreign owned? And this idea that at some point, potentially kind of important, maybe critical infrastructure in your country you're starting to sell off. Do you think that, so to summarize, if you have an extended current account deficit, which we have and the Americans have, you must necessarily be flogging domestic assets. That is what you're doing, and that is why the Premiership clubs are foreign owned and so on. Do you think that never matters, or can we reach a point where actually we should do something about the current account? And while it's great that, you know, a few ports might be foreign-owned, they shouldn't all be foreign-owned.
Right. So I think I was very specifically talking about the US, where I don't think it does matter to anything like
right.
the extent. It did matter a lot in the days of fixed exchange rates, which I'm old enough to remember, and the UK trade figures. It was supposedly caused the loss of Harold Wilson of the 1970 general election. But, you know, now nobody would know what the trade figures were. Because if you run a deficit and you fix your exchange rate, people lose confidence in the currency, and then, you know, when we're in the exchange rate mechanism, you have to raise interest rates to defend the currency. That ruins the economy. So that can matter. So I think it can matter. I think the UK, it is a bit more of a problem than it is in the US, and I think there are some strategic things that we should not allow other countries to own. The pandemic brought home perhaps that we should have some more things like some pharmaceuticals, some medical supplies that we ought to produce ourselves. So I'm not a complete no restrictions on free trade altogether. And I'd also say that China is not a free trade operator at all. Mm. And if where the grain of truth in what Trump says is that China doesn't treat its competitors fairly. If you're a foreign company in China, you can find your intellectual property taken. It does have barriers to entry. So he could have launched a particular assault on China and tried to bring the rest of the world along with him. But what did he do? No, he imposed tariffs on absolutely anybody, including uninhabited islands off Antarctica. If he wanted to make the US the leader in an anti-Chinese alliance. He went entirely the wrong way about it. And indeed, China now looks the more appealing partner for many countries in the rest of the world because it doesn't change policy every 5 minutes and it doesn't really insist on anything in terms of your domestic political setup. Biden carried on many of the, you know, original tariffs on China.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no guarantee. I mean, he's just reversed one of the things on China about letting chips go to China.
Yeah.
So if he's interested in the strategic competition to China, he's not doing that very well. So, yes, there obviously is a danger that if everything's owned by foreign countries and there's a recession, then the foreign companies cut back their UK operations and before they cut back their domestic operations. Mm. We've seen that in the past.
Mm.
But, you know, to counter that, in the UK, our car industry was a basket case in the 1970s. It got lots of foreign companies moved in, and it's a lot stronger today. And Nissan, you know, in Sunderland or whatever, that's a key supplier. And to say, well, we can't have any foreign companies owning our businesses would be extremely foolish.
Yeah, completely agree. The second question I had related to something you've touched on there, but I wonder if I could press you a little bit more. So you rightly say, list a long list of kind of America's headline domestic policy problems and say that these things have got nothing to do with China, which they don't. So that's completely correct. But you talked about China and the WTO rules and so on a little bit there. Now, let's just take one example, which would be steel.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that there's nothing kind of nefarious or hidden about China's approach to steel. China puts out five-year plans for its economy, and it's had steel in its five-year plan since the very first five-year plan. And they've literally just said, we think this is strategic. We're going to strategically invest in it. That involves doing some things which are not compatible with the purest view of free trade or WTO rules, things like cheap loans to these companies, cheap inputs, cheap land, and so on. And what you've seen is Chinese steel just explode, with the result of the discussions we're having now in Scunthorpe, and recently we've had in Port Talbot, South Wales. What's the right strategy? So Trump's strategy is the wrong strategy, but what is, or even approaching the right strategy, where you've got a country that you do want to trade with, for sure, brings a lot of benefits to the world economy, but also does strategic, targeted things which you know are going to harm your own industry. Would you have kind of limited tariffs on those industries? Or what would you do on UK steel, for example?
Well, in UK steel is very difficult. Such a small industry now. Of course, Trump is tariffing it anyway, we never mind Chinese competition.
But it's not small for the people in Scotland.
Oh no, of course no.
South Wales.
Yeah.
It's their life.
Absolutely, and it's extremely difficult. And I'm sure that my sense was uncalloused to people who work in Scunthorpe or Port Talbot. But I think a general rule is if somebody else wants to sell you something that's extremely cheap, then you should, you know, think twice about turning them down, because steel is an import to lots of other industries, and you know, it goes into many manufacturing processes. And so, if we have a source of cheap steel, that may make our other products more competitive. Now, the answer, I think, with globalization, which can suddenly decimate some industries, is that you must combine globalization with a very strong welfare state, with retraining for people, so that you do not have abandoned areas. And of course, Trump is not in favour of that either. He's not he's cutting, you know, welfare benefits. So I think you need to, the chance of us, we lost the battle on steel, I think, largely in the 1980s. I can remember what was a huge industry and the national strikes brought through, and Mrs. Thatcher and the very high interest rates and exchange rate we had at that time really was the ruin of British steel. The answer then, I think, is either subsidies to your domestic steel industry to produce things that you need, you know, for, say, defence purposes, and then, you know, there's plenty of retraining and help for the people in the industries affected.
Interesting. Thank you. Okay. It's over to you guys now, so please raise your hand if you've got a question. At the front here, on the left with the white T-shirt, go for our first question. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ling. I'm actually from Vietnam, so it's great to hear our country name mentioned a few times. Towards the end of your talk, you mentioned that the U.S. is kind of breaking apart the Western alliance. So I wonder, what do you think is the impact of Mrs. Trump's tariffs on the world order? Do you feel that any other countries has enough capacity or influence to become the new leader?
Yes, well, obviously, China would have the capacity and influence to be the new leader, but it doesn't pursue an open trading policy itself. I think Martin Wolf and Paul Krugman talked about this on their podcast recently. Probably the best approach is for everybody else to get together and say, despite what the US does, we are going to trade as freely as possible. We are going to remove as many barriers to our trade as possible. And then the US is 20% of the global economy, but it's a smaller proportion, and Richard might remember what it is, but I think more like 10 to 15% of global trade. So we can, the rest of us can get by without the US. There's an interesting example, Brazil, he's threatened with 50% tariffs. Brazil has a trade deficit with the US, but its exports to the US is only 2% of its GDP. So, it can survive without the US. And a lot of that's coffee. And I noticed in the latest inflation numbers that coffee is one of the fastest rising prices that we can see. So I think it's unlikely that we will have a leader in the same way that we could. I mean, the EU is the other alternative to China as a global leader. But the EU, you know, it's for all its many boons, quick and decisive action is not something you associate with an association of 27 countries. But we don't necessarily need that. I think we just need to live up to the agreements that we already made. And I think that most favored nation rule is a good rule. And if we follow that, then trade will continue to be mostly free, and that will allow the world economy to expand. And maybe, you know, artificial intelligence, green energy breakthroughs will make that possible and lift us out of this particular rut that we've got stuck in.
Great. Let's go over here. I saw some over here. We're going to take groups of three, actually, because there were so many. So let's group them together. So first one there, then there was somebody just in here somewhere, two people, white shirt, and then a colourful shirt. Thank you.
Hello. Just a quick question. Do you think in a few years' time you might be writing a book about the economic consequences of Mr. Farage? And if that is a yes, what do you think the major consequences might be?
I do worry. Yes.
We've got 15 minutes, so yes. we're going to group them together.
I've got them written down.
Since around 2000, the United States has benefited enormously by the capital markets funding federal deficits.
Yeah.
Do you see any relationship between Trump's apparent policies, however confused they are, and trying to sustain that addiction to foreign capital?
Right. Shall we take them in the order to which...
whichever order you like.
So, Farage, yes. I do worry about this because I've just... I wrote a piece of my Substack about the problem of low growth in democracies, because you have... if you can't grow the economy, it's a zero-sum game, and tax rises or spending cuts, the winners don't thank you and the losers hate you. And so that leads to a general disillusionment. So we've had the Conservatives for 14 years, we've now had Labour. Basically, the problem is the same. The economy isn't growing. We want European-style social benefits and we want to pay US-style taxes, and you can't square the numbers. And so Farage will come in from outside, you know, with his populist shtick. And if his stated policies, of course, make absolutely no sense in the way that Trump does. He wants to cut taxes massively, and it's all going to be funded by eliminating DEI programs or net zero or something. And the councils that have gone in, the reform councils have said they're going to cut the spending on DEI, and of course there aren't any diversity officers for them to cut. So I would worry about it, whether in practice he would appoint some
more sensible lieutenants having got in. I don't know. But my biggest hope is that he is so slavishly devoted to Trump. I think he suggested that Parliament be recalled so when he does his state visit so Trump could address Parliament, that will count against him in 2029, as it did in the Australian election and the Canadian election, that being a Trump toady won't win you votes. So the second question was...
Reciprocal tariffs,
yes,
and political change, the 2028
right.
election. Could we kind of get back to where we are? How long run, how damaging is this,
yeah.
I guess?
So it looks like about the only country that is going to has imposed reciprocal tariffs is China. China has a wonderful advantage that it makes rare earths and things that the US really needs, and a lot of stuff that the US wants. So it can hurt the US in a way. The EU, there are countries within the EU that are frightened of Trump imposing extra tariffs. I don't think the EU will get agreement. And will it make a difference in 2028? I very much hope so. We've got the midterms in 2026 that we'll see. The problem for the Democrats is which way they go. Do they go with another centrist candidate, or do they go to the, you know, the Mamdani AOC wing of the party, which is, you know, definitely the way to create enthusiasm. It's a question of whether they'd face such an enormous media backlash in the US. You know, we think our media can be bad sometimes, but when you've got Fox News and all the rest of it, a candidate like that might be destroyed before you even get to November, and that would be the worry. George McGovern in 1972 would be an interesting example if you know your history. Capital markets, funding and deficit. Now, the very interesting thing about that question, Sarah, is that there was talk of this... Mar-a-Lago Accord
yes.
earlier, in which the US proposed taxing people who funded its
yeah.
deficit, which is a very strange approach. And then we had this Section 899 of the budget bill, which was going to impose tariffs on, propose taxes on people who bought US finances to in reciprocation. That was dropped very quickly from the bill. And none of these Mar-a-Lago things... Mar-a-Lago, witless farrago is what I called it. None of those have come forward. So I think there is a genuine worry in the long run if the US loses this soft power, if it alienates all its allies, if it looks like the Federal Reserve is no longer an independent central bank, mm. if it looks like there's no constraint on deficits, whether the US will be able to fund itself beforehand. In that case, the problem that, you know, that Trump is talking about of the trade deficit, which isn't really a problem now, might become a problem in future, because it would be much more difficult to fund the deficit by attracting international investors. You'd have a much lower dollar and higher interest rates. But that's a problem caused by Trump rather than a problem that Trump is trying to solve.
Okay, let's go to the centre now.
I
know, I haven't forgotten about the top. So top, you guys are in the centre. Any questions at the top? There's fewer people. No, okay. Black shirt in the middle here. And then there's a gentleman with a white shirt and a gentleman with a blue shirt, both at the back.
Right, we can take them all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, hi. So first, as an American, I feel the need to say sorry. but you mentioned a little bit about tariffs, and I understand that's the purpose of the discussion. But thinking of the political changes and some of the war and kind of like more warmongering, and do you see a sort of a change of industries also kind of happening as a consequence of some of his policies?
Right. Okay. Great.
Yep. Thank you very much, Philip and Professor. I'm just speaking on the dollar. Do you think the dollar is being weaponized as a useful system in Trump's current administration? And what risk do you think that poses for the global South specifically with the weaponization of the dollar and its effect
right.
on the global financial system?
Okay, great question.
Yeah.
Okay.
From your perspective, do you think Trump marked a turning point in how US presidents use economic power, like tariffs or tax cuts, more for political goals than long-term policy?
Can
you say that again,
yeah.
sir?
From your perspective, do you think Trump marked a turning point in how US presidents use economic power, like tariffs, for political goals than long-term policy?
Let's deal with the first questions. And then,
then we'll come back to you. Right, so the first question was...
So political change,
yes.
the extent of political change, and will we actually see a change in industry? And look, Phil, as chair, I might monopolise a bit more and say,
yes.
like, just the extent of political change, Look at the New York mayor. Here in the UK, we've had Farage, which somebody mentioned over there, but you know, Jeremy Corbyn's just set up a new political party. I saw somebody, some polling of that, saying immediately that's got 10% support. The places we have worked, the Financial Times, The Economist, which you would broadly call centrist, there's clearly a loss of faith, a loss of support for that, and interest in the political wings, both left and right. I think the question was, that given that level of political change, do we need to see a deeper change in the industries countries have as well? But I'd be interested in your views on both left and right.
Yeah, so I think we've clearly seen a sort of breaking up of the two-party monopoly in the UK. It's taken long to have an effect because we have first past the post, and we had this kind of incredibly skewed election result where Labour won this huge majority with 34% of the vote. But I don't think that's sustainable. And if you look, of course, in other countries, you have France, you had the old Gaullist party and the Socialist Party have virtually disappeared. Macron invented a party and became president. France, you know, the CDU and the SDP, their share of the vote has gone down a lot. Italy, you have new parties coming through and becoming same in Spain. So the same thing is going to happen here. And I think it's the point I was making to that gentleman over there, that in a low-growth world, you just have constant dissatisfaction. The bargain that politicians make is vote for us and we'll make you more prosperous. You vote for them, they don't make you more prosperous. And so then you get annoyed. Will it have an industrial change? I mean, I think the point I didn't make in my speech, which I should have done, is that the vast majority of people work in services. And services are less affected by, he hasn't really tariffed services, but it's, some of course are driven by manufacturing. But the changes there, I think, are going to be to do with what is potentially an enormous impact of machine learning, call it AI, whatever, on a lot of service jobs. And there's been some very, as a father of a 22-year-old, there have been some very worrying figures out recently in both the US and the UK in the difficulty in college graduates in getting work. And companies just not offering the same entry-level jobs that they used to college graduates. Mm. There's another book, which some of you may have read and they may not believe in, but it's about the elite overproduction. And it talks about how revolutions come when you have a lot of educated people and they don't have work. And this causes... hello, Pete. This causes an amazing reaction. And it happened, if you look back over history, then many of the people who led revolutions, including Fidel Castro, were college educated. So I think that's the main fear I would have about that. The second question
This was a great question. The weaponization of the dollar, and again, I'll broaden it out a bit. The dollar is a huge tool, isn't it, for America? And it's not just in the way that Trump has been using it most recently, but of course, through the banking system and the correspondent banking system, where the US is able to have a really outsized impact, and it's used it, for example, in Iran, not recently, over the past decade. Is that the use of that tool? We know that in lower income countries, they tend to rely on the dollar because often they don't rely on their own currency. So you've got this thing that people in the global south, as the question to put it, rely on, and then that's being used and potentially made volatile by policy in Washington.
So I think there are two elements to you. Don't you? There's the level of the dollar, right? So does weakening the dollar have an impact? And obviously, if you weaken the dollar, other things being equal, though your exports are more attractive, imports more expensive, that would change the trade deficit. So there's an argument, and the dollar did fall quite a lot. But then Trump always talks about a strong dollar, and when the BRICS countries wanted to organize an alternative to the dollar, which would be a way of weakening the dollar, he's threatened them with some ludicrous level of tariffs just for even having an idea. Then the second thing, which I think you were just talking about, is putting sanctions on countries, cutting them out of the global payment system because they have policies he doesn't like. I think that's extremely likely, right? Because he will react with anger to the slightest slight on his honor or his nation. I think the great, there's this thing that he just took Chelsea won the World Cup trophy yesterday, and he took the trophy home. But, you know, things like that, with somebody with that amazing ego, South Africa's president suffered this terrible diatribe against him when he came into the Oval Office. I think that's a genuine problem. I don't think Bitcoin is the answer as an alternative. Bitcoin is just mainly a haven for speculation. But it could be that other currencies could be used to replace the dollar, including, you know, probably the euro would be the best bet in the global payment system. And I genuinely think other countries should think about that. It would annoy the hell out of Trump. But if you get enough of a critical mass, then you could at least weaken the dollar's overwhelming hold. Can I just raise one
of
other
course,
point,
yeah.
Which is in financial crises in the past, the Fed has stepped in supply dollars to other nations' central banks to try and stop the crisis. I'm not sure that Trump would think that's a good thing.
Mm,
and I wonder, the next financial crisis, which could be caused by crypto, they won't do that. And that could make the next financial crisis a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge part of 2008.
Yeah.
I was at the Bank of England at the time, if those dollar swap lines hadn't, that would be huge. Final bunch of questions over here. So there's a lady at the front. Sorry, we couldn't hear.
Oh, yes,
we're running out of time. Phil will be round the corner signing books, but also you don't have to buy a book to talk to him.
No.
Come and chat. Will you bring it up? We'll take it at the end. There's a lady here in a blue dress at the front, then a gentleman in the middle, and then a guy right at the back with his hand up highest. Go for it.
Thank you. I'll go quick. Do you have any view on what Trump's impact will be on tourism in the US?
Right. Good one.
Well, thanks for the lecture. I found it very insightful. My question is a bit beyond the US and about small emerging economies with, say, whose currency is not a reserve currency. Often these countries tend to import more than they export and run very unsustainable trade deficits and then eventually a big current account deficit. And obviously they are not very keen on, you know, giving up on, you know, going for a floating exchange rate, perhaps because a lack of depth in their markets that becomes very volatile. And they're not quite keen on giving up on sovereign monetary policy either. So what's more easier for politicians is just to pull the levers of trade policy. This basically apply big tariffs, so just completely outright ban imports or apply very restrictive quotas, which is obviously not the right approach. What's your take on that? Thank you.
Okay, not on that one.
And then about that, yeah.
Thank you for the inspiring talk, sir. My name is Antonius from UCL. So my question is, Mr. Trump itself is the political consequences of the previous presidency's economic policy, especially in the globalization. And what is the lesson learned of this kind of economic consequences of Mr. Trump for us to reflect on how we define the globalization post-Trump era, so we're not back to the square one of this kind of ultra-nationalist MAGA. Okay. Movement. Thank you.
So, tourism. Yes. Well, we know there has been an impact on tourism. There have been big declines in tourists going to the US. Canada, of course, is a big one. That's quite an important tourist thing. There was a flurry of stories, which made me concerned, having written an anti-Trump book, about people being stopped at the border for having critical comments about Trump on their computer. And I don't know how much that's going to continue. And we've also seen, you know, people who out slightly have broken the visa rules and some, you know, they did some babysitting while they were in the US and they were accused of working. And tourism, of course, is an export. Domestic tourism is an export. So he's weakening the trade deficit again by doing that. I think the soft power of the US has been substantially weakened. It will show up in tourism. It shows up in Tesla sales. You know, Tesla, fantastic brand 10 years ago, terrible brand now. And that's all to do with politics, the politics of Elon Musk by being associated with Trump, isn't it? So I think that the tourism will probably suffer a permanent damage because the US seems a less nice place to go. But of course, under the next president, it might alter.
And then the last two, very briefly, because we must let people... Yeah. Low-income countries do sometimes use them to protect themselves.
Right.
So do they have to follow the same rules of free trade?
Right. Well, there's the infant industry argument, which I think, you know, the US used and Britain used, you know, a long time ago. So there are some industries which I think countries are entitled to protect. The whole policy of import substituting industrialization, which Latin American countries did, India did for quite some time, didn't prove to be very successful. All you got was, or it leads to corruption, which tariffs generally lead to, because favored businesses, you know, bribe the government to put tariffs up. Then they produce shoddy products and consumers get stuck with them. And India, since it dropped that policy in 1991 onwards, Manmohan Singh, has, you know, fantastic growth, growing faster than China now, you know. There are many countries, South Korea and Taiwan would be ones where it wasn't that they lacked government intervention, but they were very concentrated on building up exports. And I think being open to export is the key thing, more than, you know, dealing with imports. And the final
last
question,
one, what's your vision? What's your positive, hopeful vision for post-Trump globalization?
Right. The first is that the other countries of the world get together and say, well, this is clearly disastrous. Alan Beattie writes some very good pieces for the FT, an old colleague of mine. He just did something about this. You know, you're seeing a bit like Britain with Brexit. We took one for the team, did something stupid, and everybody else go, well, we're not going to leave the EU now. And so Trump's policies, by being so clearly wrong-headed, will teach other countries not to do this. But the impact of globalization, I think we've seen it, is that it can cause immense disruption to particular localities and particular sets of people. So it must be accompanied by a strong welfare state, by an active government that is willing to intervene, subsidize some industries, and support workers when they are affected with regional aid or any other thing. What you cannot have, or, well, you shouldn't have, is globalization and a minimal state. You need the state to back it up.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening. That's been absolutely fascinating. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'd like to thank Phil again personally. I see this, and also the team that put it together so quickly, I see this as a kind of modern-day pamphlet, and I mean that in a good sense, of some of the economists you cited, Ricardo, Adam Smith. They would see something wrong with the world, and they'd get something written, and they'd get it out quickly, and we often don't do that. It's a small book. It's a great read. I know pubs near here where a pint costs more. Phil will be round the corner signing copies. Please do get one. And it just leaves me to ask us all to thank Phil for coming to speak to us here tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.